This is The End User, episode 92 for Monday, April 30th, Retoasterator. Hello and welcome to The End User, the show where we get together and talk about our experience with consumer technology with a bit of news from your perspective. The End User.
It's the tech news that you can use.
I am your host and producer, Chris Barnes.
And I'm Taylor Marr. So Chris, I remember you really wanted to talk about Google Drive. Last week, we had the scoop. We supposedly had all the details, but now it's real.
Now it's actually happening. We always try to avoid talking about rumors a little bit because, you know, it's like, well, I don't know what's actually happening with that. But now this is live in the flesh or live in the bits.
Pretty much everything that said was spot on.
Yeah, it was all spot on.
We have all the details. It's all integrated. It's all free. There's going to be apps for everything.
Yeah, and it's a little weird because I got an update on my Android phone and it said, there's an update for Google Drive. I thought, well, I don't have Google Drive yet. And the key was that they're migrating Docs to Google Drive. So actually, I did have Google Docs installed and they're just renaming it.
Oh, really?
So I go and I take the update and it installs the update and then I launch it and it says, Google Drive is not enabled for your domain. So then I had to go enable it. So I'm still waiting on Drive to actually show up and be useful.
And in the meantime, it broke your Google Docs app.
Yeah, it did. I can always log into the web interface and that's fine though.
Right. Well, what I've been doing. But actually from the web interface, you can't edit all documents.
Yeah, it's only some subset. The Google Doc, the like native Google Docs, you can.
Right.
But I think if you import something funky like that, then sometimes you can't edit it.
No, well, so in the mobile version for iOS, at least, I can edit spreadsheets, but not text documents.
Hmm, interesting. Yeah, and the Google Docs app in the first place was just basically a wrap around the web interface anyway. So it wasn't really that great, to be quite honest.
Yeah.
So I'm still waiting.
But let's talk about what people can get with this, you know, despite the apps that they already had.
You start at 5 gigabytes for free, and you can work your way up to 1 terabyte for $50 a month.
They have even higher than that. I don't think they're available to consumers though.
Yeah, for like Google Apps, domain, business.
And so, but your Gmail doesn't count towards that.
Yeah, it's its own separate bucket.
And neither do your native Google Docs.
So it's interesting. Do you think you're going to actually use this one?
I mean, I'll definitely try it. It may replace Dropbox for me, but I don't use Dropbox that often.
Yeah, me neither. I of course, just like you, I have an account with all of these things and with SkyDrive and Dropbox. And shortly, I'll have a Google Drive account. And I don't really use them that much, to be honest. I did use them a lot when I was in school. I guess my document needs are a little lesser so now.
Yeah. Well, I do still use Google Docs a lot for personal and professional uses.
Right.
And so I think the fact that Google Docs is fully integrated into this, just, you know, having more access to apps, you know, because like I said, there never was an iOS app or a Mac app for Google Docs, but now there is for Google Drive.
Yeah.
So maybe that'll help me. It remains to be seen because I haven't been able to try it out yet.
Now, it's a little weird. When you do actually get the Docs app, it shows up with files that are not actually files that you open and then it takes you to Google Docs in a web browser.
Oh, that's a little weird.
Yeah, it's a little weird. You know, I think it was .gdoc was the extension, and that's a little strange. I mean... They should really have, if they really want to be an Office competitor, then they need to have a native client for Mac and Windows. The web is not the end-all be-all of everything, you know? They need to really have native apps if they really want to get after Office.
Right. Well, they always had the advantage of having better collaboration.
Yeah.
And they wanted that to be web-based. But now that Microsoft and Apple and even like OpenOffice and LibreOffice, now that they're all going towards that collaboration route, Google Docs has to go back the other way and make it more full-featured like the rest of them.
Yeah, it's funny. You know, Google Docs has always been really good at the cloudy stuff, the collaboration, the, you know, everything is through one interface that gets updated automatically, that kind of stuff. But the picture of their using it as a word replacement is a little shaky at best.
Yeah.
I mean, what about references and stuff like that? There's no notion of caching references and making automated works cited and stuff like that. They're just they're not quite there. If you have really simple needs in editing, then it's fine. But if you have a little bit more complicated needs, then it's not fine. So for example, for our show notes for the podcast, it's fine, right? Because we just put little links in there and you know, we come and talk about them. But if your needs are a little more complicated, it's really, even with Google Drive, it's still really not quite enough.
It's just an outline. You can't really get anything ready for publishing, something that you're gonna present in an official capacity. Like, you know, you can't really make a resume on Google Docs or a thesis.
Yeah, although you always look around the technology landscape, no matter what the technology is, and you think, well, if I could just take that bit from over there and this bit from that place over here and then mash them together, that you'd have this such an awesome product. And I think we're kind of heading toward that with all these drive services. You know, they're all figuring it out, and they're all figuring out the business plan, and Google's here.
Yep. So they're making waves that way. They're also making waves with Galaxy Nexus, available unlocked for AT&T.
Yeah, so this is pretty cool. They're getting back to their roots. Remember, the original Nexus device made by HTC was sold.
Right, when they would just sell it only on the Google Store. And they shut it down because no one was buying them, but I guess they're going to give it another go. And so if you have AT&T or T-Mobile and you don't want to sign up for a two-year contract, then you can pick up this phone, and it's a pretty good deal. $400 with no contract is pretty sweet.
Some people might look at you and call you crazy because you said $400 for a phone is a good deal, but it's unlocked. You do not have to have the baggage of being locked to your carrier, so you can take it and leave and go somewhere else, you know, I guess between AT&T and T-Mobile.
Right, that's the only problem here.
Yeah, well, that's the problem we have in the United States, is that we don't have real portability between carriers.
Yeah, definitely not the portability that they have in Europe.
No. So, but yeah, this is cool. HSPA Plus, $399. It's a nice phone, ice cream sandwich. I mean, in some ways, this is the ultimate Android phone right now.
Yeah.
It's the pure Google experience, right?
Right. And like the Sprint version of the Galaxy Nexus, but not the AT&T version, or not the Verizon version, it comes with Google Wallet. It's got that NFC technology built in.
Yeah, and I think they're still kind of waiting to figure that one out. It's not going to take off. It's just like a test bed as it is right now. This is the only phone.
Why they give you a free $10 credit.
Yeah, this is the only phone that even has the capability.
Uh-huh.
There are other phones that have NFC, but there are not other phones that have Google Wallet, to my knowledge.
Right.
So anyway, that's pretty cool. I wish that more companies would make their phones available unlocked like this, so I could just buy the phone and then put it on whatever carrier. But of course, the carriers are the ones with the real powers. They're not going to let that happen. Only Google can do it, right?
Right.
Yeah. Only Google has the resources to not be afraid of getting pushed out of the market or something like that.
Or maybe Apple. But Apple seems to bought into the carrier method.
No, I mean in the Android world.
Yeah.
Apple absolutely would as well. Cool. Well, speaking of Android, we've got another Android phone. We've got a little bit of details on the Intel smartphone that we talked about last week. It's looks like an Intel architecture with Android on it. There's not a whole lot of wiggle room there. It's basically, you know what Android is, and here's the phone, right?
Right. I mean, the processor architecture is so different. I imagine that it has to be...
It's completely custom, I'd imagine.
Yeah. I have to imagine it's, you know, markedly better at some things and worse at other things.
Yeah.
But I like the name. It's manufactured in India by a company called Lava International, and they're calling it the Zolo X900.
Zolo X900. That sounds like a sci-fi villain of some sort.
It does, yeah. Or like a sci-fi villain spaceship.
Yeah, it's the analog to Darth Vader would be Zolo in perhaps the Stargate universe, let's say. That would be reasonable. So yeah, the Death Star phone, that's what we'll call it.
You've gone way too specific and scatterbrained with your analogy here.
Yeah, so this thing is going to be $420, 4-inch screen, 8 megapixels, you know, all the stuff you'd expect.
Yeah, but you won't be able to get it in the United States.
Yeah, and this is the thing, Intel isn't going to make, if they just do this, there's no reason to go get an Intel architecture phone, right?
Yeah, it's a strangely small step, you know, a first step into the mobile market. You'd think Intel would be able and willing to do a bigger gesture, you know, a phone that's more widely available and more aggressively marketed.
Yeah, like, look, we're partnering with HTC or somebody big like that. and offering an Intel phone of some sort. That would make a little more sense to me. But I guess they're just kind of sticking their toe in the water, right? And they're releasing this phone in India, unlocked, and with a custom version of Android on it. It's a little weird, but...
It is weird, but they must just be nervous about it.
Yeah, I guess so. They should be.
Figured out what they're doing.
They should be, because ARM has eaten their lunch in the meantime, right?
Yep.
So it looks like SkyDrive is also going to rival Google Drive. We've got Drive Madness here. But they've come out with a native Windows application and a native Mac OS X application as well. And their deal is that you get $10 will get you 20 gigs, $25, 50, $50, 100 gigs, and you get 7 by default. You know, the free 7 gigs. Unless you're like me and you had SkyDrive previously, then you get to opt in to 25 gigs for free.
Ah, okay. But still, this is, some of these are cheaper than Google Drive and some of them are more expensive.
Yeah, it kind of splits the difference, right?
Yeah, it's a little weird. Like, because Google gives you 5 for free, but this gives you 7.
Yeah.
But then Google gives you 25 gigs for $250 a month. Whereas 25 gigs here you can't get, but 20 gigs is $10 a month.
So what's a little bit cool is that you can use Windows Live Mesh to sync things between separate custom folders instead of just having like a Dropbox, which is what the SkyDrive app does. If you go use Windows Live Mesh, then you get to sync custom folders and do stuff like that. So that's a little cool. But I'd have to imagine that if they have a SkyDrive application, that they're trying to move SkyDrive outside of Windows Live Mesh, and they might kill Live Mesh at some point.
Yeah, I have no idea. I've never used Live Mesh. I haven't been able to use SkyDrive either because it wasn't available for OS X. But oh wait, now it is.
Yeah, they've got, well, at least for Lion.
Right. But I haven't, so I'm not worried.
Yeah, you're not worried about it. But yeah, do you think you'll give it a shot?
I'll watch the videos. I'll read the reviews, and I'll probably download the software and play with it. But you know, I think there's no particular reason for me to use this over Dropbox or Google Drive right now.
Yeah, I think for Mac people, I get the sense that Mac people tend to be Google people as well. And I think it would kind of make sense for them to use Google Drive over something like SkyDrive, just because, you know, you got one more ID that you got to worry about. And, you know, do you really want a Microsoft ID? So I can understand that kind of thing. Well, you must have a Hotmail email account. Like
I have an MSN.com that I used for their live chat service about 10 years ago.
Yeah, and it's something like computergeek127@hotmail.com or something like that.
Well, yeah, sure.
Yeah, something like that. No, don't give it away on the air. That would be a bad idea.
Well, that's not mine, so I'm not going to give it away.
Yeah. But yeah.
I do feel really bad for computergeek127, though.
Oh, yeah. Poor guy. I don't know. These applications are kind of interesting. We'll see. I think there's room for all of them, right? Dropbox is kind of the client that you use for your mobile apps because it has the recognition and it's built into a lot of them and is so cross-platform. It's so ubiquitous that you might as well use it. And, you know, iCloud is for Apple people. SkyDrive is for Microsoft people. And Google Drive splits the difference, right?
Yeah. There's a lot of options now.
Yeah. Where there was really Dropbox was the only option. And then SkyDrive was kind of lurking in the background as a great deal that nobody used, you know?
Right. I think we've covered it. Is it time to turn on the afterburners?
It is time to turn on the afterburners. Taylor, would you to get some gigabit Wi-Fi?
Oh, man. That would make the afterburners go so much faster.
Yeah, it would. We're getting the first round of gigabit Wi-Fi routers that are coming out. The R6300 is coming out. And I don't know. This is really, really, really interesting. We haven't had a new wireless spec. I mean, N was just kind of a stopgap and helped with HD video. But this is really the next frontier. So check out the Netgear R6300 if you want to get some gigabit Wi-Fi speeds. That's pretty exciting.
Yeah. I would still wait, though, probably.
Yeah.
I mean, especially since there aren't any computers that have this built in.
Yeah. Wi-Fi enthusiasts, beware.
Linux enthusiasts, beware of Precise Pangolin. It's Ubuntu 12.04, the latest release. Now, Chris, you had a little bit of chance to play with this new release, haven't you?
Sort of. I tried to upgrade, and it kind of borked everything, so I'll have to reinstall it. And
maybe wait till the next release, Quantel Quetzal. I'm excited about that one, just because of the name.
Just because of the name? Nice. Yeah, they've got a lot of tweaks to the user interface that seem to make it a little more friendly, so I'll have to have some time with that a bit later.
So you've also been playing with the consumer preview of Windows 8. Now we've got reports that they're going to have a nearly final release preview in, what, like 6 weeks from now?
Yeah, that's right. So in early June, we're going to see the release preview. And notice they're not calling it a release candidate because they have not gone the beta release candidate route. They've been calling them previews because they want to make sure that you know that they're not taking any of your feedback.
Well, I guess that's important to them.
Yeah, yeah. Well, anyway, so I'm pretty excited about Windows 8 in general, and this is the next milestone, so I'll be checking it out.
Cool. Will it be free, like this one?
Yeah, it'll be free, and you can download it, and it'll be just like last time, I'd imagine.
Interesting. All right, well, that's all the afterburners we have, so let's turn them off.
Yeah, turn them off. Let's slow down a little bit and get into the end user stories. You've got to watch for us, Taylor.
Yeah, so we have briefly talked about Bluetooth smartphone watch accessories, but we've kind of passed them off as gimmicky.
Moto Active, remember that one?
Right, but so now there's one that has gotten a lot of buzz because they put their project on Kickstarter and they raised $100,000 of funding, which was their goal, in less than 2 hours.
Yikes.
And so I'd imagine that this is going to become a reality in the marketplace fairly soon. It works for it's going to be Bluetooth and it's called the Pebble, and it's going to work with iPhone or Android, and they have an open API that works with all of these apps. So they have kind of their own app store of some kind. Technically it's a little unclear on that, but definitely there is a fairly simple way for people to write their own code and connect the watch with whatever, but they already have fully functioning bike and running applications, as well as golf course range finders.
Cool.
So it connects to your phone, uses the GPS in your phone, and then displays on the watch, you know, where you are in the course, what the par is, how far you are from the pin. Pretty crazy.
Yeah, I think the idea of having some kind of display on your body that's not in your pocket, you know, like on your wrist or, I don't know, wherever, kind of makes sense. You know, you want to get notifications and stuff like that. You want to have some tie-in with your phone. You know, the processing power definitely should be on your phone, but
yeah,
it's definitely a good idea to have an optional external accessory to make your phone a little bit more useful. I mean, how many times have you pulled out your phone, turned the power on, unlocked it, looked at the weather, turned it off, and put it back in your pocket immediately? Man, I do that kind of stuff all the time.
Yeah, I check the time on my phone probably 10, 20 times a day.
Yeah, so I think it makes a little bit of sense to externalize that to a device that's on your wrist. And the e-ink stuff makes a lot of sense because it's low power, right?
You don't need a big old battery. It's a really slim device, and they say it'll last 7 days of average use.
Yeah, if that refresh rate is fast enough, you could even like read tweets and stuff like that, you know, maybe get at replies, stuff like that on your wrist, and so you don't have to take out
your phone. I'm sure it'll be fast enough for that.
Yeah. So I don't know, it's a pretty interesting idea, and it's captured people's imagination for what it's worth, so it seems like a good idea. Also, I think they're using one of those Microsoft fonts on there, aren't they? On the renders they have and the video in the CNET article.
I don't recognize the font.
Yeah, that looks...
I suppose that red watch does kind of look... It looks very Windows Phone 7-esque.
Yeah, I think the font they're using there is at least of the same family as the Windows Phone and Media Center fonts. Interesting.
Chris, I think it's just some sort of sans serif font. I think we can put the font issue to rest. All right, well, we do have to put that to rest because we have another contentious issue to talk about. And this is based on a comment that Tim Cook, the CEO of Apple, mentioned about trying to combine tablets with laptops, right?
Yeah, and so here's the quote, and then we can talk about it. "You can converge a toaster and a refrigerator, but those things are probably not going to be pleasing to the user." And I wanted to put this in there not because the quote is terribly important, but because it kind of represents my philosophy to computing, where you can put a little bit of computing in every place where it makes sense for you to have computing. And Taylor, you've got the kind of opposite opinion, where you want to converge all your devices and have one or two really useful devices that do just about everything, right?
I don't think it has to be one or two. I think the way technology is right now, people aren't going to really need to use more than one or two. I think it's more important to have all of the data that you want synced across all of the devices that you're using, right? So the more computers you have, the more difficult it is to have that photo album that you put on one computer or you took with your phone and try to access it from all your other computers. You can use the internet to do this, but you know, who wants to keep all of their photos just on Flickr or Picasa or something? You want to have it on your device. You want to have it in your network. So it doesn't matter how many devices you have. There just needs to be a way for all of it to combine in a way that makes it easy to use. And for most people, there's no way to do it beyond one computer, maybe two, and you can get a tablet and a smartphone in there too. But that's about it, unless you're willing to really put in the distance and create your own system for remembering where everything is and accessing it.
Yeah, or the way I treat that is I have the server that is the central location for everything, and all the client computers talk to the server when they want to see their photos and that kind of thing. And all the client computers, like the home theater PC, looks at the server for the music so that you can have all kinds of devices and still have your content.
Right.
Geeky for most people, right? Yeah. Most people are not going to get Windows Home Server at all.
I feel like from my 2007 to 2009 or so, Microsoft was really trying to push the home server on the average user, and it just didn't work.
No, they don't want it. It's too much maintenance.
They don't want it. And that's exactly the problem. The home server would be a great solution, but there is no great home server for the average user.
Yeah, and I'm not sure there's a way to have a home server be great for your typical home user.
But there has to be a way. Our needs are not going to get so complicated that people will want a home server with all the inconvenience that comes with it. There has to be, in some unrealized combination of technologies, a home server that will be accessible and desirable to the average home user. And at that point, you're just going to have a server, a laptop maybe, or a desktop, a smart TV or a media center PC, TV or something, and then your smartphone and your tablet. But you're just going to have one of those. You don't need a tablet in every room. You don't need a computer in every room. You don't need six laptops. You need to have something that coordinates it all, and then you only need whatever you need. Not everybody needs a laptop. Not everybody needs a tablet. And so that's my point. You don't need 10 computers. You need something that makes everything that you want work together.
Yeah, so here's the example. In Windows 8, you can, let's say, move your taskbar to the left for some reason. And Windows 8 will actually sync those settings between your computers without a server. So I agree with you in the philosophy of you need something to centralize things, but I'm just not sure that thing is a home server, even though that's what it is for people who are patient enough to set one up.
Okay, yeah, true. The solution may not be a home server. It may be some other sort of setting synchronicity.
Yeah.
But I mean, I don't care where my taskbar is. I don't want my computers to automatically sync my taskbar location.
Well, you don't
that's
have
not,
to. It was just
that's
an
not
example.
The point of this. It's about your data and about your information. You want to have, when I open 10 tabs on my laptop, if I have to leave, I want to see all those 10 tabs on my phone. If I make a slideshow on my tablet, I want to see that slideshow on my computer.
Yeah. So it's a continuous client.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know. Whoever realizes that notion first in a user-friendly way is got a big opportunity, I think.
Yeah.
So there are little bits and pieces of where you can do that kind of stuff, but I think we're just starting now to realize that, right?
Right.
Yeah. So what do you think? Refrigitoaster or no refrigitoaster? The refrigerator and the toaster. Do you think that's a good invention?
It doesn't matter whether they're combined. It just matters whether they're talking to each other.
When you have to cool your toast after you... No, that doesn't make sense.
No.
But I would kind of want a refrigerator toaster. That sounds like an interesting combination. People would come into my house and be like, is that a refrigitoaster? Yes, it is.
This one cools things down. This one heats things up. Can I have cold bread? Yes, yes, you can.
Yes, you can.
Well, it's an interesting quote, but the metaphor only goes so far.
Yeah, it breaks down after a while, right?
Right. So, but okay, I think we've made our points.
Yes. Until next time, Mr. Marr.
Until next week.
Same the end user channel.
Are we both the bad guy now?
I think we are. Yeah. That means we did something right. If we both end up being the bad guy in the argument, then we did something right.
Yeah, that's true. Whatever is the solution that eventually appears in order to get people to use these multiple platforms and get it syncing across the board, whether it's a server or not, I would venture to guess it's a pretty safe bet that Intel's new processor architecture is going to be involved.
Yeah, unlike the smartphone industry, Intel's new Ivy Bridge architecture will likely be involved if you're talking about non-mobile computers.
Right. Now, we've been calling it Ivy Bridge for months, but it's worth pointing out that that's just an internal code name, and now that they've actually been released, you won't find Intel calling it Ivy Bridge anywhere. It's just their third generation Core I architecture. And they've got they're building transistors that are only 22 nanometers across.
Right.
And so this is brand new technology. And what that means is that it's faster and it uses less power and produces less waste heat.
So when you get a smaller architecture, you can pack more of it. You can have a chip that's more dense.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It's interesting. They keep making... This is a pretty large jump over Sandy Bridge, no?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of how small they made the processors. It's not a huge jump in performance, but it will be a huge jump. Let's say you have the same laptop. One's got Sandy Bridge, the last generation. One's got Ivy Bridge. You're going to, it's going to do things about the same. If your solitaire card jumping is not going to be faster.
Yeah, I remember on a previous episode of The End User, you shared with us your past generation method of performance testing.
Right. Yeah. How fast the solitaire cards jump out when you beat the game.
Yeah.
That doesn't work anymore.
Nope.
A dated example, but so. These two hypothetical laptops will perform about the same. The new one will perform a little bit better, but it will have much better battery life, and it won't get as hot doing the same tasks. And that's, I think, really the key, because laptops are still way too hot.
Yeah, they do get pretty hot. And I think the only exception to that is if you're doing something like video encoding, something super intense, then you may actually see a difference, right?
Yeah, you'll see like a 20% improvement.
Yeah. So that's interesting. Is there any reason for somebody to upgrade from Sandy Bridge? Probably not.
No, not unless you want the latest, greatest thing, or your Sandy Bridge laptop is way too hot for you and you'd be willing to do anything to replace it.
So in comes the refrigerator and you can cool the laptop down.
Right.
Yeah.
But it's also worth pointing out that they have released the high-end versions of their chips. So that's only the expensive desktop versions and expensive laptop versions. If you're looking for an average or cheap laptop, those chips aren't out yet. So you should keep waiting.
Well, I also just bought a Sandy Bridge Core i3, and I guess they didn't release the Ivy Bridge Core i3 yet. So
they've only released i7s and a handful of i5s.
So I can rest a little bit easier knowing that I'm not quite as lagging behind as I am.
Except that they're definitely going to release those i5 and i3 processors within 6 to 8 weeks.
Yeah, soon. That's okay. I still have to put a kilowatt on my new Sandy Bridge i3 home theater PC.
See how much it's pulling?
Yeah, see how many watts that thing is pulling at any time.
Yeah, well, it won't be a huge difference between Sandy Bridge and Ivy Bridge, only because the rest of the components in your laptop are pulling so much more power than the motherboard at this point anyway.
Yeah, well, it depends on what you're doing. I mean, for example, the audio aspect of it, that's in the chip. So when you use that part of it, I bet you would see some benefit in that.
Right.
Well, anyway, we don't have any numbers to back all that kind of stuff up. So we'll have to keep your eyes tuned to a non-tech or something like that.
Yeah. if our listeners want to know about that, they know where to find it.
You'll get all the numbers you want.
Okay, well, now that we've gone over that, it's time for my green tech stories of the week. I have two little pieces here, which I thought were really fun. A researcher and a scientist and a gamer, who are all one man,
walk into a bar,
decided to do a study finding out how much energy platform game consoles use. So we're talking PlayStation 3 and Xbox 360 for the most part. And more importantly, how much energy they're using when people aren't playing them, right? So if you want to play a PS3 game, it's going to use a bunch of power, but that's what you have to do if you want to play that game. So, but what happens when you leave the PS3 running when you're not using it? And it turns out that PlayStation 3s and Xbox 360s in 2010 generated roughly 16 terawatt hours. So that's 16 trillion watt hours of wasted energy just by being left on when somebody wasn't using them. It's 1% of all household energy consumption.
Wow. 1% sounds minuscule, but the market is large, right? So that's actually a ton.
Right. I mean, it's 1% of peak energy that could be eliminated just easily with a firmware update, or if people just turned off their machines when they weren't using them.
Yeah, or at least put them to sleep.
Right. It's a big deal in terms of energy efficiency that could so easily be fixed. There aren't any 1% changes out there in most of the market.
Yeah, it's funny because on one side of things you say, well, it's completely needless power consumption, right? Because you're not there, just put it to sleep or turn it off. And on the other hand, the newest Xbox only consumes 94 watts. It's like leaving an incandescent light bulb on all day. These things are so efficient that could be a lot worse, but as it is, it's still needless, right? That's not to say it to justify it in any way, but it's still needless power consumption. You just put the thing to sleep.
The Xbox, when it's on, it consumes 94 watts, but the old Xbox 360, with the original one that they released, used 172.
Yeah, and that starts to get a little more interesting.
Yeah, I mean, my whole laptop that I'm using right now, it only takes 65 watts.
Yeah, and I know the wattage of the power supply I'm using, but I don't know how much wattage the computers are actually using at any given point in time.
Right.
I've got some kilowatt experiments to do, I think.
I guess so.
Yeah.
You've been talking about it a lot today. Well, good news, though, if you use a Wii, it has an auto standby feature, and even when it's active, it only uses a couple dozen watts, one-fifth the amount that the other consoles use.
Yeah, well, it has less computing power, and therefore it uses less power, right?
Right.
It has less computing power, therefore it uses less electrical power.
That is true. So my other green tech story for the week is also about using less power, or using power more efficiently. And this comes from Tesla and a solar panel installer called SolarCity. So when the Tesla Roadster first came out, I talked a lot about how they had tried to make a performance car really efficient. And one of the big ways that they did that was they put billions of dollars into battery research. And they came up with a really great battery. They started a whole new factory making these batteries. And so now they're going to start selling the batteries to a solar panel installer. And this is a big leap for people who want to put solar power battery backups in their home, because previously you had to buy all these industrial components which weren't meant for this sort of system and put them together with all these converters and stuff. Now they're going to start selling very high-end batteries with a system that's designed to take full advantage of the battery and the solar panel together. So it's pretty cool. It's nice to see that awesome battery that's in the Tesla Roadster and the new Tesla sedan and put it use somewhere else. And if you want to take your home off the power grid, then this is a good way to do it.
And to me, it's maybe not necessarily off the power grid, but at least lower your impact on the power grid, right?
Yeah, sure, that's true. However, if you have a this is where the difference comes in. If you have a grid-connected solar panel, it's still going to be much cheaper to just sell your excess energy back into the grid as opposed to have your own battery backup connected to the solar panel.
Right.
So in that case, it wouldn't really make sense to buy one of these Tesla battery systems. But I've lived in a house with a grid-connected solar panel, and it was awesome. Our bills were really low.
All right, well, let's move on away from green tech and into our tip of the week. And you found this one, as seems to be the case every week. You're a lot more useful in the tip of the week realm than I am.
Well, that's mostly because I read Lifehacker. But I thought of this one because I was playing with your Kindle Touch last night and said, wow, this is really great for reading stuff that's not books. And then I saw this story that Amazon has just released their latest Send to Kindle software for the Mac. And I guess they already had it for the PC. And you have a couple of different ways to send it. You can send it straight through Wi-Fi. And you can send it to any device, you know, if you have more than one Kindle or if you have a Kindle app on your iPhone or iPad or something, you can send it through Wi-Fi or you can send it through the WhisperNet if you have one of those 3G Kindles.
Nice. So I had no idea that this was the case. And apparently the Windows version was released in January. So I'm going to have to go download this and see what's going on with it.
Right. And if you'd rather read blogs on your Kindle, I can tell you firsthand that reading at least text-based blogs using Google Reader, just on their mobile website on the Kindle, was a dream. And if you have a Nook instead of a Kindle like I do, you should root it and then check out their Google Reader software, which was also pretty good.
Cool. Yeah, it looked pretty interesting. I didn't realize that Google Reader's mobile website would work well on a Kindle Touch, and it was surprisingly nice, actually.
Yeah, I liked it more on the Kindle Touch than I did on my iPhone, but fortunately I have an app for that instead.
Yeah, I'm going to have to start doing that and see how it goes.
Okay, that's the tip of the week. I guess it was a bunch of little tips of the week.
Yeah.
Mostly only useful if you have a Kindle or maybe a Nook.
And what I really want to do is play Tetris on my Kindle Touch at some point. Maybe.
Well, can you do that? I have Tetris on my Nook.
No, I don't think so. Or at least I don't know of a way.
Right. Well, but if you are at MIT, you might have seen Tetris being played on a building.
What? How is this possible?
Well, so they just put LEDs in the windows of a building that happens to have a large grid of closely connected windows, and then they just had Tetris going in it all night.
Cool. That's pretty awesome. So they had 153 wireless color-changing LEDs. That's pretty cool.
Right.
It's almost like the biggest TV ever with really big pixels.
Basically, yeah. Except they only had a couple of colors in there, so it could only play Tetris or things with Tetris colors.
Yeah, but that's really neat. They need to open this up to the public. Like, why don't they just make a building where that's just what happens and make a little like station outside the building somewhere so that people can actually use it? That would be even cooler.
You know what though, Chris? No one is stopping you.
That's true. I should do that.
Yes.
I can imagine some kind of Arduino network with Zigbee that could do that. Seems likely.
Right. Do you think letting people play it for $5 a game, would that...
No, 99 cents a game.
I don't think you'd ever make your money back at 99 cents a game.
Probably not. So I'm going to Kickstarter right now, and I'm going to start that. No, I'm not going to start. But it'd be cool if someone did. Just
yes,
not me.
Probably cheaper to just get a projector.
Probably. Much cheaper. Then you could potentially get some kind of resolution out of the thing instead of just the lights. So anyway, I'll get to work on that, and that'll do it for this week.
Yep.
So, Taylor, who are you on Twitter?
I'm still me on Twitter.
You're still you? Good.
Yeah.
Is that at still you?
No. No, but I don't pretend to be someone else on Twitter.
Oh, okay. So you're not fake Steve Jobs or,
no,
or
not,
fake,
nothing like that.
Fake Al Gore or fake John Dvorak or whatever it is?
There's a fake John Dvorak?
I'm sure. I'm just making it up, but I'm sure there is, actually.
Well, so my handle is at TaylorPhone.
Okay, and I am at Chris Hale Barnes. So thank you everyone for listening to the show, and of course you can find more information and the show notes at thedigitalmediazone.com. That's under the end user. It's THENDUSR. The DMZ has a few other podcasts, so have a look at Entertainment 2.0 for Media Center, Scene in HD, and the Movie Podcast, and you can send us some feedback. Our email address is theenduser@thedigitalmediazone.com, or you can just ping us on Twitter. We are at theenduser. You can join us live sometime. We're still undecided on what our regular live time is going to be. This one's been working out, but we may need to change it. So just pay attention on Twitter, and you'll see when we're live. I am your host and producer, Chris Barnes.
And I'm Taylor Martin.
Thanks for listening, folks. We will see you next week. Bye-bye.